Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Deep Dive. You know, you, our listeners, you guys send us some really interesting stuff, and this time around, we've got these excerpts, these snippets from a teaching session, and it looks like they're really digging into this question of when Jesus might return. Like, how did those early Christians, people like Paul, how did they understand that whole idea of the timing of the second coming?
Yeah, exactly. And so I think, you know, for this deep dive, our mission is pretty straightforward, but it's a big one, right?
Yeah.
We want to try to really unpack what Paul's letters tell us, what clues they give us about the timing of Christ's return, that presagia. So did Paul think it was going to happen like tomorrow, you know, super soon, like within his lifetime? And to get like a wider view, we'll also look at the book of Acts to kind of set the stage.
Right. And I think what's so interesting about these excerpts, these are kind of like snapshots of a teaching environment. And we're not here to like, you know, fact check these early figures and say, oh, they got it wrong if things didn't pan out exactly as they might have expected. Instead, I think what we want to do is zoom in on certain passages, these key phrases, and try to, you know, really get a feel for the original context, the subtle nuances, the language, so that we can arrive at a, you know, a clearer, deeper understanding of what they were getting at. So where do you think we should start with all this?
So I think a really helpful starting point for considering that there might have been a time lapse before Jesus' return is actually the book of Acts.
Yeah.
So, you know, Paul's letters are our main focus mm-hmm. today. But Acts, I think, really lays some important groundwork. It gives us some context.
Right. Acts, which picks up after the Gospel of Luke. And I'm thinking specifically of Jesus's words in Acts 1:8,
right,
where he's giving this powerful promise of the Holy Spirit.
Exactly. So Jesus says to his disciples, "You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth." And what's interesting is, if you look at how the entire book of Acts unfolds, this verse, it almost functions like a blueprint. It's like this geographical outline for how the message about Jesus is going to spread.
Okay, so it's like a divine plan of action, and it starts local and then it just expands outwards.
Exactly. It just keeps expanding.
And that expansion, I mean, that takes time, right?
It does. So just that inherent aspect of a widespread mission suggests that Jesus's return wasn't meant to be immediate. There had to be time for the disciples and those who follow them to actually go out and do this global witnessing.
Right. I mean, you can't be a witness to the ends of the earth if, you know, things are about to change dramatically. And the source material even mentions Craig Keener's commentary on Acts, where he points out that this phrase, the ends of the earth, it likely extended even beyond Rome, which is interesting because that's where the narrative in Acts concludes.
Right. And so for you, our listener, what's fascinating here is that while Acts doesn't give us a specific timetable, it definitely leaves room for, even hints at, this idea that there's a period of time, that there needs to be this time for the message to spread. And so this fits with the idea that the New Testament authors, including Paul, might not have actually expected an immediate return, maybe not within their own lifetimes.
Right. Okay. So Acts kind of lays the groundwork for the possibility of a non-immediate return. So let's shift gears a little bit. Let's look at Paul's letters. And I think our first stop on this Pauline exploration should be 1 Corinthians chapter 7, where Paul is really wrestling with these very practical, down-to-earth issues around marriage and singleness.
Yeah, exactly. And within that chapter, verses 25 through 32 are especially relevant to our conversation.
Yeah.
About when Jesus is going to return. So there are three key phrases in this section that a lot of people have pointed to over the centuries to say, look, this means Paul thought the end was imminent. And those phrases are present distress, the time is short, and this world in its current form is passing away. Let's unpack these one by one, see what we can learn.
All right, sounds good. So first up, present distress, verse 26. Now, you know, if someone were to read that today, they might immediately think of, the tribulation, some future time of trouble associated with the second coming. But our source material suggests that maybe we need to think about more immediate context for the Corinthian church, like what was going on in their lives at that moment.
Yeah, exactly. So while you could make a connection to future eschatological troubles, the word present really points us to a very real issue that these Corinthian believers were facing right then and there in their present circumstances. So maybe it was a famine, maybe some kind of local persecution, maybe just like the general hardships of life in that time and place. But the present nature of it really roots it in that first century setting. So a direct link to the future second coming, like the primary meaning, it's probably less likely. So when Paul is advising them to consider remaining single in light of this distress, he's really talking about navigating those immediate circumstances.
Right. It's about dealing with the challenges of their current reality, not necessarily about, the very end of time. Okay, what about the next phrase then? The time is short. Verse 29. I mean, this one really sounds like Paul thought that, the clock was ticking.
It does on the surface. But here's where it gets really interesting. And I think this is a key insight for you, our listener. The Greek word translated as short, it's actually a participle. It carries this meaning of shortened or compressed. So Paul's perspective in our source really highlights this, is that with the first coming of Christ, the end times, they'd already been set in motion. They'd already begun. So for Paul, believers were already living in this final period of history.
Oh, so it's not so much about, how much time is left on the clock, but more about a fundamental shift in how they view time itself.
Yeah, precisely. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 10.11, Paul says that the Corinthians are those upon whom the end of the ages has already come. So they weren't waiting for the end to begin. They were living in it. They were in this time of eager anticipation of his culmination. So when Paul says the time is shortened, he's not giving us this countdown. He's emphasizing this new reality, this new reality that's been inaugurated by Christ's arrival. And there's a real sense of urgency because they're in the final era and Christ could return within that time frame, within that shortened time frame. Okay, so it's not just about, the quantity of time. It's about the significance, the quality of the time that they're living in. This creates a real sense of urgency about how they should be living their lives.
Exactly. It's not a prediction of an immediate return, but it's an encouragement to live with this heightened awareness of God's kingdom breaking into history.
Okay, that's a huge distinction. It completely reframes how we read that phrase. Mm-hmm. All right, let's tackle the third one from 1 Corinthians 7. This world in its current form is passing away. Verse 31. Again, I think the initial thought might be, okay, this is about, the literal end of the world. Like the planet is going to dissolve.
Right, that's a very natural first thought. Mm-hmm. But the nuance here lies in that phrase, the form of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony Thistleton, in his commentary on this passage, he points out, and our source highlights this, that Paul is probably talking about the external structures of the world, the social structures, the economic structures, the institutions. And he's saying that these are the things that are in the process of fading away because God's kingdom has arrived.
Okay. So it's not that, the planet itself is going to immediately disappear, but it's that the way things are in the world is undergoing this fundamental transformation.
Yeah, exactly. And Paul's not giving us a date for when this is going to happen. He's making this point, and I think this is important for you, our listener, to consider. These temporary structures, they shouldn't dictate how believers live, what their values are, how they act, because these structures are already on their way out because of what Christ has done, because the end times have begun. So he's shifting their focus to what's eternal, not these temporal systems.
All right, so looking at all three of these phrases in 1 Corinthians 7, it seems like the main point isn't so much that Paul is predicting an immediate end, but rather he's trying to reshape how the Corinthians understand their current reality in light of the fact that Christ has come and the end times have dawned.
Precisely. It's about a change in perspective, not a, a precise timeline for the parousia.
Okay, let's move on then. And I think we should look at 1 Thessalonians chapters 4 and 5. And specifically, that resurrection passage in chapter 4, starting in verse 13, the one that's often read at funerals. Now, one phrase that stood out to a lot of people is that phrase, we who are alive, in verses 15 through 17. And that's led some to believe that, okay, Paul definitely thought he would be around to see Jesus return.
Right. That use of we, that first person plural, it definitely creates a sense of inclusion, like Paul is including himself in that group. Mm. But if we just keep reading, if we go to 1 Thessalonians 5.10, Paul says that Christ died for us so that whether we are awake or asleep, we may live together with him. And asleep there is a pretty common way of referring to death in the New Testament.
Oh, so just a chapter later, he's acknowledging the reality of death, both for himself and those he's writing to before Christ returns. So, I mean, that kind of puts a different spin on that earlier we, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure. 1 Thessalonians 5.10 indicates that Paul was well aware that he might die before the parousia. So while he certainly could have believed that he would be alive when Christ returned, because after all, they were living in the end times, it could happen at any moment. He wasn't making a firm prediction about that.
Right. And the source materials even suggest that we could be understood more broadly to mean like we Christians, regardless of whether they're physically alive or not at that specific moment.
Right. Yeah. That's another valid way of interpreting it. Ultimately, I think the point for you, our listener, is this. Paul wasn't making some kind of guarantee about his own survival until Christ returned. He was writing to those who were alive and eagerly anticipating the parousia, an event that he believed could happen at any time. But he was also acknowledging the very real possibility of death.
So it's about being ready, understanding the imminence of the return, not necessarily about, witnessing it firsthand.
Exactly. Exactly. The emphasis is on how we live in light of that potential return, whenever it may come.
Okay. Now, this discussion about the Thessalonians continues in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And it seems like here Paul is dealing with a slightly different issue, the belief that the day of the Lord had already come.
Right. Right. This is a crucial point. The Thessalonian Christians, we don't know exactly why, but somehow they'd become convinced that the day of the Lord, that Old Testament term referring to this future time of God's judgment and salvation, they thought it had already begun.
And so Paul, in 2 Thessalonians 2:1-12, he's writing to try to correct this misunderstanding. And his approach is really interesting. He points to certain events that have to occur before the day of the Lord can actually come.
Exactly. Exactly. So he lays out this logic. He says, look, these things have to happen first. These things haven't happened yet. Therefore, the day of the Lord isn't here yet. It's like he's saying, whoa, 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 hold on a minute, not so fast.
And he actually outlines three of these preceding events, the rebellion or the apostasy, the revelation of the man of lawlessness, and the removal of the restrainer. Now, let's start with the rebellion. Our source mentions this, but it doesn't seem like Paul gives a lot of specifics about what this, you know, widespread turning away from faith is going to look
like. Right. And it's interesting because in verse 5, Paul says that he'd already talked about this stuff with the Thessalonians when he was with them. So for us, you know, looking back 2,000 years later, it can be hard to connect all the dots. But, you know, the source does point to some parallels in other apocalyptic writings, mm-hmm. like 1 Enoch. And even in Jesus's teachings, like in Matthew 24, when he talks about love growing cold, it suggests this widespread falling away from genuine faith. But for our discussion about timing, the important point is that Paul is convinced that this hasn't happened yet.
Okay. Then there's this figure. Paul calls him the man of lawlessness. Again, the specifics are a bit fuzzy for us, but the general idea is that he's this person, or maybe this force, that's going to stand in opposition to God and kind of set himself up as a rival. Now, the source talks about the uncertainty about whether this is, you know, a literal individual or if it's more like a symbolic representation of evil.
Right. Yeah. It's not entirely clear. And then there's this reference to him setting himself up in God's temple. And that, too, has these different layers of interpretation. Is he literally going to go into a temple building, or is this more like a symbolic act of claiming divine authority? Whatever the specifics, the point for you to understand is that this guy hadn't shown up yet. This mystery of lawlessness was already at work in the world, but the full, you know, manifestation, that was still in the future.
Right. And then finally, you've got this removal of the restrainer. And this one seems to be the biggest source of, you know, debate and speculation throughout history, because there are so many different theories about who or what this restrainer might be. The Roman Empire, you know, the rule of law, the Holy Spirit. Some people even say Michael the Archangel. Our source really emphasizes how much uncertainty there is around this.
Yeah, for sure. And again, Paul is assuming that the Thessalonians know what he's talking about, so he doesn't spell it out. But what's important for you is that Paul believed this restraining force was still active. It was preventing this full, you know, unveiling of the man of lawlessness. And so therefore, also delaying the day of the Lord. Now, we don't know for sure who or what Paul had in mind, but what matters is that he believes something was actively holding back this full outpouring of evil and the arrival of the day of the Lord. And that implies that there's this waiting period, this necessary delay.
Okay, so with these three preconditions, right? The rebellion, the man of lawlessness, the removal of the restrainer, Paul's basic argument is because these things haven't happened yet, the day of the Lord hasn't arrived yet. Which clearly implies some kind of a delay before Christ returns.
Yeah, that's right. And Paul doesn't say how long that delay will be or whether these events might even still unfold within his lifetime, but he's definitely saying that these things need to happen first. It's directly countering this idea that the day of the Lord had already begun.
Okay. It's really interesting to see how 1 Thessalonians and 2 Thessalonians, how they kind of fit together. Because the first letter, it emphasizes the imminence of Christ's return. Like, he could come back at any time. But then the second letter introduces this idea of a necessary delay, because certain things have to happen first.
Yeah, it is fascinating, isn't it? It almost reminds me of this already and not yet tension that we see throughout the New Testament when it comes to the kingdom of God. And our source actually draws this parallel to Jesus's parables, like the parable of the unfaithful steward or the parable of the wise and foolish maidens. And these parables, they highlight the need to be prepared for either a sooner or a later return.
Okay, so it seems like the early Christians, including Paul, they held this nuanced perspective. They believed that Christ could return at any moment, and that motivated them to, you know, live with this sense of urgency, this sense of readiness. But they weren't necessarily saying, okay, this is going to happen tomorrow or next week or next year.
Right, exactly. It was this tension between expecting imminence and accepting that there might be this preordained sequence of events. And that tension, it really shaped how they understood their present and how they anticipated the future.
Right, right. So when we put all this together, it seems pretty clear that Paul's writings, they don't support the idea that, you know, he was making a prediction about an immediate return. That then didn't happen, and therefore he was somehow mistaken.
No, not at all. Paul understood that the end times had already begun with Christ's first coming. And he was always emphasizing this need for readiness. Because Christ's return, he believed that was a real possibility at any moment. But he also knew that he might die before that. And he acknowledged that certain things needed to happen before, you know, that final consummation.
So this has been a really fascinating deep dive. I mean, I think it's so interesting to see how Paul addressed these different situations in his letters and how that return of Christ, it was always in view. But he wasn't trying to lay out some kind of a specific timeline.
Right. And we've unpacked some really important ideas. This whole concept of the inaugurated end times, the sense of urgency that Paul had, and the possibility that there's this sequence of events that has to take place.
Right. So for you, our listener, we'll leave you with this. How does having this more nuanced view of how the early Christians thought about the end times, how does that affect how we think about time and anticipation today? I mean, how do we balance that sense of, you know, imminence with the reality that there might be a delay? That's definitely something to think about. And our source material kind of hints that, you know, this conversation, this is just one piece of the puzzle. Maybe down the road, we'll have to do another deep dive and look more closely at, you know, the general epistles and the book of Revelation. But for now, thanks so much for joining us today on the deep dive.